Live from Washington, D.C., an American legend, this is the G. Gordon Liddy Show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, joining me now is Guy Smith. He's a regular speaker on television, radio, and at meetings of civil liberty groups. He's a civil libertarian who says that the Second Amendment is the only civil right under perpetual attack. And as such, he believes that everyone who takes liberty seriously must actively defend the Second Amendment. And he is the author of a new book that's it's really good. It's called Shooting the Bull, How Michael Moore Lies. And there's a whole bunch of other people lying in here. Dianne Feinstein, Rosie O'Donnell, Michael Bloomberg, Josh Sugarman, Barack Obama, Charles Schumer, Sarah Brady, and Richard Daley, to name a few. And Mr. Smith, welcome to the G. Gordon Liddy Show.
Pleasure to be here, and I bring you apologies from San Francisco.
San Francisco. In your book, you have a scene of Dianne Feinstein picking up an AK-47, and I don't know whether it's a real AK-47, meaning it's capable of fully automatic fire or only semi-automatic fire, and placing her finger on the trigger, sweeping the room, you know, covering everybody, which is just an insane thing to do. And you say she did it on purpose as theater.
I think she did. You know, for all my picking on Dianne Feinstein being in her formerly great state of California, she knows a little bit about the subject. And you would think somebody in her position would at least know that when you're picking up a firearm, loaded or unloaded, doesn't matter, you do not put your finger on the trigger and you do not point the muzzle anywhere near something that's living and breathing unless you intend to eat that for dinner. So when you have a room full of reporters and you're trying to have your assault weapon ban passed, holding an AK-47 with your finger on the trigger and letting the muzzle, you know, waver around is going to cause journalists probably to poop their pants and then go write prose, which is going to make assault weapons sound dangerous because they've just, you know, been at the receiving end of a barrel of an AK-47. So I think it was scripted. I think it was intentional. I think she had the desire to instill a little bit of fear in reporters so that they would instill a little bit of fear in voters.
Yeah, well, it makes sense to me. But the first objection I have to this whole so-called assault weapons ban business is that an assault weapon, by definition, is capable of fully automatic fire. And they kept outlawing semi-automatics. Semi-automatic technologies over a century old, and it's done on the basis of the appearance of the firearm.
Well, that's one of the interesting and the greatest canards was the manufactured phrase assault weapons. Now, in the Department of Defense Manual of Small Arms, which is the authority of anything that goes bang, there is something called an assault rifle. That's the fully automatic rock and roll weapons that our soldiers and competing soldiers carry around the world. Assault weapons don't exist. It's a complete fiction. And in fact, Josh Sugarman over at the Violence Policy Center, I have a copy of his document where he was talking about assault weapons as a convenient thing for them to promote. And quoting from his book, he said, assault weapons are a new topic. The weapon's menacing look, coupled with the public's confusion over fully automatic machine guns versus semi-automatic assault weapons, can only increase the chance of public support. So in other words, he was saying, yeah, we know that the general population isn't going to understand the difference, and we're going to use this as a gun control initiative.
Boy. Well, they lie constantly. And one of the things you point out in Shooting the Bull is the have this term that they use, social cost of firearms, and nowhere do they list the social benefits of firearms. And, you know, in these recent mass shootings, if there had been people present who had a firearm with them, they could have stopped the killer in his tracks. But because law-abiding people obey these gun prohibition laws, and, of course, people who are intent on crime, you know, they're willing to risk 25 to life to rob a bank or whatever, they have no intention of obeying an anti-firearm law. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things about the gun control industry is the way that they amalgamate your, you know, garden variety street thug with your cousin Bill. It's a very sick form of moral equivalency. But back to the point that you were making, the difference between social cost, social benefit, in the book I refer to this as the lie of blindness and all the different political lies that we give case study examples to in Shooting the Bull are referred that way. So the lie of blindness is this willingness to repeat factoids that have been disproven. And it was disproven a long time ago that there is just a social cost associated with firearms. Yes, there is. Street gangs, which commit 94% of the firearm homicides in this country, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, do generate some social cost. But you have to balance that with the 2.5 million times a year people use a firearm to prevent a rape or prevent a murder or to prevent a mugging. And the gun control industry refuses to acknowledge that that is part of the equation. In fact, it's very disturbing when you look at the decision in the Heller case and you see Supreme Court Jester Breyer going off on his social cost tangent that he doesn't really ever cover that reality, that people defend themselves routinely using firearms.
Yeah. Well, what of the the Supreme Court held that it is a the Second Amendment is an individual right, and but said that reasonable limitations could be placed upon it, whereupon the District of Columbia and Chicago and what have you put so many different rules and regulations into place that it became virtually impossible to exercise the right. Do you think that there's going to be a another shot at the Supreme Court?
There's going to be many of them. When the Heller decision came down and I saw that reasonable regulation clause in there, I started telling all of my Second Amendment friends, this is the beginning of the 100-year war.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is the gun control industry is going to throw up every blockade, every new rule, every restriction, every regulatory mechanism that they can find, and we are going to have to go to court over each and every one of them. And it's going to take 100 years to sort out all of this mess and to exercise each one of the regulations to prove that it is that they are unreasonable regulations.
Yeah, well, I mean, a thing that says that you can have a firearm in your home for self-protection, but don't go on your porch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so blatant, it would seem to me that, those guys that get thrown out of court, but as you say, there's some people up there on the courts that you can't get through to.
Well, you can't. And one thing I tell everyone in politics, I don't care if they're Republican or they're Democrat, liberal, conservative, when you're getting ready to vote for a president, the single most important criteria is that your candidate needs to say, I will only nominate strict constitutionalists to the bench. The reason is that if you have somebody who interprets anything but the express written will of the people who ratified the Constitution and the amendments, then we really have no Constitution. It becomes an unelected legislative branch. If we don't have a Constitution, we don't have a country. So I don't care what your political stripes are, you have to defend the Constitution, and you have to defend everyone's rights, including those rights that you may not particularly be thrilled with.
Yes, well, and the problem, as I see it, the founding fathers wanted, you know, they had just broken away from a strong central government, that of George III of England, and they were really reluctant to form another central government and for it to be strong. And so they said that the only powers that they would have would be those enumerated in the Constitution, and everything else was reserved to the states and to the people. But through a horribly twisted interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, we have virtually nullified the intent of the Founding Fathers. And, you know, the government can regulate just about anything.
And I'm familiar with the rulings that you're talking about, and it was that point in time, in the late 1930s, early 1940s, that America devolved from being a constitutional republic into a mere democracy. And the problem with a mere democracy is all you have to do is convince 51% of the population to go do a stupid thing, such as taking away your neighbor's freedoms,
yes,
and it will happen.
Oh, my. Well, do you think that the gun control people, you know, this coterie of people who are so upset that the rest of the population might possibly exercise their Second Amendment rights, do you think that it is ignorance of firearms, or does it have nothing whatever really to do with firearms and everything to do with we want to control everybody's every action?
Well, I think it falls into two camps. And, you know, I've gone toe-to-toe and debated with a number of pro-gun control people over the years. The first camp are the utopists, the people who have this vision of what a perfect world would be without guns. And, you know, I try to remind them of places in Africa where people don't have guns, and the barbaric activities that go on there are, you know, are worse than we can possibly imagine here in the United States. So the weapons aren't the variable. And, well, you know, on that matter of fact, I could take them to Compton or to take them to Washington, D.C., where guns have basically been illegal for a long time, and show them, you know, that the violence continues unabated. But aside from the utopists, there are the people, the elitists, the social engineers, the people who believe in, you know, nearly fascist-level central control of society, who believe that government should dominate the people instead of the people dominating the government. And they are only somewhat crypto about it, but they come real close to saying, you know, we don't want the people to have the right to resist the authority. And that is part of their equation. They want to make sure that the people are subservient instead of the government obeying the people.
Mr. Smith, we need to take a short pause for the benefit of our advertisers. If you'd be kind enough to just stand by for a few minutes, we'll be right back to you. I'm speaking with Guy Smith. He is the author of Shooting the Bull, How Michael Moore Lies, and then a whole host of other people. And it's really well done. And I urge you to buy a copy, read it, and make sure all your friends read it. We'll be right back.
Liddy.
I'm back with my special guest, Mr. Guy Smith, the author of Shooting the Bull, How Michael Moore Lies, and then a whole bunch of other people. And you, the way you organize your book about the different kinds of lies that the gun control people tell in order to attempt to persuade people of their point of view. Would you go into what you consider to be the most egregious?
Oh, that's a tough one to pick, because when you look at how clever they have been over the years and this huge variety of lies that they've come up with, or at least modified, it's really tough to pick which one is most egregious. I would have to say, though, that one of the worst ones is where they take people from different camps and they inappropriately combine them so that the sins of one camp are cast onto the other. They will quite commonly lump criminals and people who commit suicides and people who have a hunting accident and then broadcast it as if all of these were the same cause, the same effect, and the same problem. And what's fascinating to me is that almost regardless of which type of lie they're telling and what the topic of the week may be, everything leads back to this one central goal that they have, which is registration of firearms. And this fascinated me for a while until I finally figured out the end game. Because registration of firearms doesn't control hardly any of these factors that they talk about. Registering a firearm does not change the probability of an accidental death. Criminals, the Supreme Court ruled, aren't required to register their firearms, so that's kind of, you know, a lost issue right there. So why does registration always fit in? And the reason was that Pete Shields, the former head of Handgun Control Incorporated, which before then was called the National Coalition to Ban Handguns, registration was the middle step towards eliminating firearm ownership in America. The first step was to slow production and slow consumer access to firearms. Second step was to register them. Third step was to confiscate them.
Yeah, well, that's what happened in Australia, and the violent crime shot up.
Well, it also happened in New York, and it also happened here in California. Places where registration have been enacted inevitably lead to something being confiscated from somebody. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that some people on the political left don't get, why gun rights supporters keep resisting any move towards registration. We've seen it in history. We've seen it, you know, when the Nazis came to Germany and used the previous regime's registration scheme to confiscate guns from the Jews. We've seen it. And we've seen it in many places around the world. It eventually comes down to disarming the people.
Yeah. Well, and it's such an old thing. I think it was Pope Innocent III when the crossbow was invented, and so an armored knight could be brought down by a peasant. They introduced a crossbow control.
Mm.
They've been at it for centuries. Well, there's just enough time left, Mr. Smith, for me to thank you for being my guest and for urge everybody to get a hold of Shooting the Bull. That's the name of Mr. Smith's book, and it's absolutely first rate. And thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you, sir.